I read poems, besides other things, and hike, and read Tolkien. I'm going to do a couple of sessions on Tolkien before I'm through up here. And this is one of the greatest places in the world to read Lord of the Rings, because you can't be anywhere without being aware this is the kind of stuff that Frodo and the boys went through on their way to wherever, whether it be the land of Elrond or Sauron's, or you go up by the mine up there and you think you're in the bad part of the country. So for those of you who haven't read, I'm not here to talk about Lord of the Rings today, but I just clicked in my mind. If you haven't read it, you may want to come to, I think I'm doing it Wednesday at 4 o'clock right here, talking about Tolkien and the Hobbits. And if you have read it, you can help me talk about it, because I always find people remember things that I forget and vice versa. It's one of those things you have to read about 15 times before you're really conversant, and I'm a long way from having done that. But it's one of my favorite things. I've always been pretty much convinced that Lord of the Rings is... I'm going to start talking about that yet, if I think so. Turn my mind off. But I've always been convinced that Lord of the Rings is one of the 10 great books of world literature. I've never argued that with anybody. It's not the kind of thing I would argue. It's seems to me it's like arguing that roses are one of the 10 best flowers or something. I don't know how you could substantiate that unless you like roses. But this is about poems. What I want to do tonight is today is read some poems that I like and that I've liked for a long time. Some Robert Frost, some Dickinson, Yeats, some other people, Mark Van Doren. And just kind of share some of those things. Sit here and read. Wednesday night, after 6:45, I'll be reading from my own books, my own works. And then Saturday, I'll be giving a reading of from a book I wrote about the bicentennial year. We traveled around the country and tried to write a poem about all the states, like sometimes two or three poems about states. So we're taking a look at kind of bicentennial America via those poems on Saturday.
What time?
I think that's 6:45 too. But today is just some favorites of mine. I like to start when I read poems. I like to start with Robert Frost for all kinds of reasons, and the simplest being that I like him a great deal. I've always thought that I liked Frost immediately when I first read him when I was in school, and I never stopped liking him. I think there probably are those people who would say Robert Frost is, yes, he's nice, but he's not, he doesn't really say anything. He's not terribly intellectual. So why? I don't see that everything has to be terribly intellectual. As a matter of fact, Frost is intellectual, as everything is intellectual, as everything is emotional. And the good things, I think the best things, are things that are intellectual and emotional without being overtly so. Frost doesn't stand up and wave flags and say, watch this, here comes an intellectual thing. He just does it. And when he does it so conversationally that you're not aware of what he's doing usually. There's a very brief poem, only two stanzas, that I like very much. Sometimes when I teach at CLC in Thousand Oaks, California Lutheran College, I start with this one, and usually the students are, I'm through before they realize I've begun. And they say, is that it? And it's called The Pasture by Frost, and it goes like this. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. And then I kind of watch the reaction of some of the students. If they've never been in the Midwest or on a farm, sometimes it takes them a couple of poems to get in with Frost. And sometimes I'll get a reaction like, that's a big deal. What does it say? What is its relevance? And that's the magic word that makes my Irish boil when I hear the word relevance. It's words like relevance and interact have always been unfavorite words of mine. And although we're sitting in a circle, but we're not interacting, we're just talking about poems. I recently went to a conference in St. Paul where the speaker was one of the greatest theologians, one of the greatest minds I've ever heard, Joseph Sittler, tremendous person, from the University of Chicago. And he's blind, he can walk around pretty much without walking into things, but he can't read anymore. And so he sat up on a little platform, and every time on the way up and the way down, we were just holding our breath, afraid he would fall. He's a big man, ungainly, Sam Johnson kind of a man. And he sat there and drummed the tabletop for a while, and he says, you know, I can't read anymore. And he says, when you can't read, it does one thing, you have to think. And he thought out loud for 3 days, and it was just an amazing experience. You wonder where I'm going with this story. My point of digression is that when we got through listening to Joe Sittler, then the people who ran the conference said, now we'll break up into buzz sessions, which is the other word that I don't like, and interact. And I knew when I heard that, I was in for a bad 3 days. It was a blind meeting the blind, so I don't like to interact, so we'll just read poems. But that's Frost is like this. He had a couple farms in Vermont and New Hampshire, and somebody asked him, what's that poem about? What is it saying? He said, did you read it? I said, yeah, I read it. He said, what did it say? He said, well, you're going to go out to clean the pasture spring. Frost says, that's right. He said, well, what do you do out there? He said, I rake the muck out of it. You know, dead leaves or branches that fall out of trees. I kind of keep the water clear so cows or horses are thirsty. They can drink something besides dead leaves. Oh. Is that it? He said, that's it. But he said, well, that's not so bad. I don't know what they expected poetry to do to him. But he said, no, it's not so bad. I think you could probably take one or two of those. And, not as a daily diet, maybe, but not so bad. Frost was a terrible farmer, of course. His grandfather left him a couple of farms, and which is nice to have somebody leave you a couple of anything, of farms. But he was liked to think of himself as a gentleman farmer. He didn't grow much, and people used his land and that kind of thing. He liked just being able to walk around and climb fences and things like that. And that's my idea. I'm from a farm in southern Illinois, and all dirty farms. And but my grandfather didn't leave me any. Here's one that I'm sure that you know. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, which is just a nice poem. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. I guess it's hard for me to read Frost sometimes without thinking of the critical essays that have been written about Frost. Then they're not very good, most of them, but it's just that Frost is the kind of person that you shouldn't write critical essays about too much, because he's just honest. And there's a famous story of that line, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Why he repeated that line? Well, one critic said, why did you repeat that line? Frost said, I liked it. And the critic shook his head and said, oh no. Frost says, oh no? The critic says, oh no. He said, you repeated that line, Mr. Frost, because it's a death wish. And he proceeded to take the poem apart piece by piece and show Frost how he couldn't wait to die, you know. And that last line was a clincher. And Frost says, very interesting. He said, but you're wrong. Yeah, but of course you can't get critics off quite that easily. The critic was sure he was right. And another poem that's not, and let's see if I can remember, it's very short, about like this, by William Carlos Williams called The Red Wheelbarrow, that goes, So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's it. Just a brief little poem. And another critic asked William Carlos Williams why he wrote that, then proceeded to tell him, of course. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow. The critic wanted to know, why does so much depend upon a red wheelbarrow? Why red, if that doesn't indeed stand for the red planet Mars, bloodlust, revenge? Glazed with rainwater was obviously expiation for one's sins, God's grace filtering down. And he got to the white chickens. He couldn't do anything with white chickens. He said, that's too bad they weren't Rhode Island Reds or something, some color. But the white chickens, he thought, was a bad line. So he dismissed that. William Carlos Williams was a doctor. He was a pediatrician in New Jersey. And he'd been out delivering twins that night. And he was very, very tired. And he got back. He was walking back across farmland to his house, to his farm. And it had been raining, a light rain, and he stopped to have a cigarette or smoke his pipe before he went into the house. And it was already light. It was about 6 in the morning. And some chickens were just scratching around the barn, as chickens will do. And there was the old wheelbarrow up against the barn that had collected some rainwater. And he thought, for that one moment, that was the most beautiful sight he'd ever seen. And he just took out a back of a piece of an envelope or something and said, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Stuck it in his pocket. Tremendous poem. And what its relevance might be, I'm not prepared to say, I don't even want to think about its relevance. I mean, the relevance in poetry, it has always seemed to me, since I remember reading my first poem in the 6th grade or 7th grade, was always obvious. The poem was its own relevance. Like saying, what is the relevance of a bird? I hope nobody ever asked me that. What's the relevance of music or a baby? But some people must have relevance, so I guess you've got to, that's what graduate schools are for. They give you relevance. I once had a class at SC. Well, I had two classes at SC this one particular summer, but we were reading Melville and reading Melville's poems, which are not as good as his novels. And I was talking about a poem, and I said, talking out loud, and my turn to say something intelligent in the seminar, and I said, he uses hard sounds in this poem. And the prof stopped me. He said, what'd you say? I said, he uses hard sounds. The prof said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you know, G's, K's, as opposed to soft sounds, M's, N's, S's. He said, where did you hear that? I said, where did I hear it? I didn't hear it anywhere. He said, what critic said he uses hard and soft sound? And the prof just raked me across the coals because I couldn't substantiate hard and soft. And I thought anybody knew that. G's were hard and S's were kind of nice sounds and M's. And I had the temerity to not quote the critics. So that's what graduate schools are for. I don't want to get on graduate schools either. I happen to go to a very good one, University of Nebraska, but even the good ones have their moments. The road not taken. Two roads diverged in yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, and took the other, that's just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted to wear, though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And that's Robert Frost. You can do that at Holden. Which way to go? Another thing I like about Frost is he doesn't belabor the point. You notice he doesn't give you a little sermonette on the fact that the road he took, what difference it made. He just says it made all the difference. His life could have turned out terrible because of that path, for all we know. Of course, everybody puts the other connotation in it. He turned out to be a man. Well, maybe he did. Well, he doesn't say. I like that. You You know The Death of the Hired Man? I hadn't planned to read so much of Robert Frost, but my mind is on Frost. Do you know that poem? It's a narrative poem about, and again, Frost is kind of a simple, not simplistic, but simple way of telling a story, that Warren has his farm, and Mary, his wife, and her, Warren's come back to town or something, and Mary says, the hired man, Silas, has come back again. And from the poem we learn that Silas is not all that great shakes of a hired man. He's been there before. When I was a kid in southern Illinois, we had such a hired man. His name was Charlie Stokes. And Charlie would come and go. And to us kids, of course, Stokes was God. He told us stories, often ribald and bawdy, that my aunt would try to shut him up from telling. We would gather around the pot-bellied stove in the parlor with our feet up, and Stokes would spit on the stove, and my grandmother would chase him away and make him sleep in the barn. And then us boys would try it, and we were sent to bed. Nothing as romantic as sleeping in the barn. We all assumed the barn was a very romantic place to be. Anyway, The Death of the Hired Man is about such a person. Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after her. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms, set them on the porch, and drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said, that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg and be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, and someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind him bettering himself, if that's what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money in haying time when any help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to me. I'm done. Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to sooner or later. He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here, huddled against the barn door, fast asleep. A miserable sight, and frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him, and he's changed. Wait till you see. Where did you say he'd been? He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off. What did he say? Did he say anything? But little. Anything. Mary confessed he said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me. Warren. But did he? I just want to know. Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect. He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you heard before? Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times. He made me feel so queer to see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson. You remember the boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they two will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. The way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought all through July under the blazing sun. Silas up on the cart to build the load, and Harold alongside to pitch it on. Yes, I took care to keep well out of earshot. Well, those days trouble Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would. How some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I know just how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold saying he studied Latin like the violin, because he liked it. That an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe he could find water with a hazel prong, which showed how much good school had ever done him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. I know, that's Silas's one accomplishment. He bundles every forkful in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference so he can find and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in bunches like big bird's nests. You never see him standing on the hay he's trying to lift, straining to lift himself. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good, perhaps, to someone in the world. He hates to see a boy the fool of books. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now, and never any different. Part of a moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with the dew from garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard some tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. "Warren," she said, "he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time." "Home," he mocked gently. "Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course, he's nothing to us any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn out upon the trail. Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve." Warren leaned out and took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back and broke it in his hand and tossed it by. "Silas has better claim on us, you think, than on his brother. 13 little miles as the road winds would bring him to his door. Silas has walked that far, no doubt, today. Why didn't he go there? His brother's rich, a somebody, director of the bank. He never told us that. We know it, though. I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'd see to it that there's need. He ought to write to take him in and might be willing to. He may be better than appearances, but have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he had any pride in claiming kin or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you, Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind that kinsfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't quite as good as anybody, worthless though he is. He won't be made ashamed to please his brother. I can't think Si ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart the way he lay and rolled his old head on the sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made up the bed for him there tonight. You'll be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that. I haven't been. Go, look, see for yourself. But Warren, please remember how it is. He's come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at him. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon." It hit the moon. Then there were three there, making a dim row, the moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned too soon, it seemed to her, slipped to her side, caught up her hand, and waited. "Warren," she questioned. "Dead," was all he answered. That's also Robert Frost. Great narrative voice, great conversational tone. If you have any questions or comments as we go along, hope you'll feel free to say something or ask whatever. Nothing sacred about this.
You know, how did Frost get started writing poetry? Did he go through college?
Yeah, he did. Well, no, he didn't actually graduate from college. I've forgotten just offhand whether he went a year or something like that. That wasn't, he didn't graduate. And he started writing as a fairly young man.
Just for the fun.
He said he liked to write for the sound of words, just liked to hear them. And, of course, he's got that great New England Yankee tone, a hard flintiness to it. Even though he's talking about something as sad as the death of a hired man, it's still hard. Frost was born in San Francisco, interestingly enough, and his father was a politician of sorts, and they went to New England when Frost was 7 or 8 or 10, something like that. So he's really New England. But you know, you have to be New England for years, really, to be New England, right? Frost is New England. This fellow, Mark Van Doren, this book's in the bookstore, by the way. So I just saw it today, 100 Poems by Mark Van Doren. This fellow, in my opinion, is one of the great American poets and greatly underrated simply because he was writing when Frost was writing. And that's like playing center field when Mickey Mantle was healthy in the Yankees. He used to do a lot of bench sitting, you know. And but he came along at the same time. He's more metaphysical than Frost. He's awfully good. They bought a farm in up northwestern part of Connecticut. Anybody from Connecticut here? Cornwall Hollow, that area. Yeah, right. And they have 150 acres. I spent 4 days with Dorothy, his wife, a few years ago. That's an interesting story in Mark Van Doren's autobiography. He taught at Columbia in the city, in New York City, and they would take drives around the country. And they were driving up his old Model T one year, 1927, I think. And he came up this old dirt road that dead-ended, beautiful rolling hillside with pines and hemlock and a lot of ferns. And there was a farmer sitting on the end of the porch of this old farmhouse and had about three barns and a little trout stream with an old mill wheel. It was just like Eden, you know. And Mark Van Doren just knew it. He had to have it. It was his place. So he leaned his head out of the window and said to the farmer, "Is this place for sale?" The farmer spit his tobacco and said, "Might be." And Van Doren said, "Well, how much might it be?" The guy looked around, looked at his wife, and said, "Maybe 5,000? Well, 5,000 in 1927 was a goodly sum, but he hocked his gold teeth in his car and everything and got the 5,000. And it's a beautiful place, was just appraised about 3 years ago at $375,000. But that the price is not, it's the beauty of it. And they lived there since, well, 50 years. And after Mark Van Doren died, his wife Dorothy still writes articles and things for magazines. And she wrote this one piece I read in Atlantic or some magazine a few years back about what it means to be New England. And the person who had talked to her about the article had interviewed her neighbors over the hill, about 50 acres away. And they said, "I'd like to talk to you about the Van Dorens." And the people said, "Who? You know, the Van, oh, you mean the people live on the Bradford place." 50 years later, but you're still on the Bradford place. Well, that's what it, I guess I'm not going to make it. I've been in California too long to, and nobody cares, of course. They don't know me either, but not for the same reason, because nobody knows anybody. You're all behind fences there. It was a pleasure to be back in St. Paul 3 weeks ago and be able to look down the street and see everybody's backyard for six blocks. And maybe people who live there would just soon have more privacy, but for someone from Southern California, that's pretty nice. Let me read you a poem by Van Doren. It's called Sleep Grandmother, which is a very nice poem. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The rocking chair is ready to go, and harness bells are hung in a row as once you heard them in soft snow. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. Your sons are little and silly again. Your daughters are 5 and 7 and 10, and he that is gone was not gone then. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The sleigh comes out of the winter woods and carries you all in boots and hoods to town for candy and white dress goods. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The rocking chair is old as the floor, but there he nods at the noisy door for you to be dancing one dance more. If you haven't read Mark Van Doren, I think you'd really find these poems, as I say, they're in the bookstore, really, really fine poems. He was a prof, English prof at Columbia for 45 years, and excellent critic, and there aren't many people that I would say that about, because I don't like criticism very much, but he was a good one.
Was it their son who was on the $64,000 question?
Yeah.
That celebrated incident?
Does that ring a bell in some of the people who...
You gotta be old enough.
Watched early TV, yeah.
In the 50s?
Yeah.
Charles Van Doren.
Yeah, that was his name. Now, what was he? What was his work? Was he a teacher? Right.
He was a prof at... Well, I've forgotten. He was either at Columbia or Harvard. And that ended that career pretty much.
Yeah. What's he doing today?
Well, he's doing all right. And he's vice president of Encyclopedia Britannica. And the other son, John, is editor of The Great Ideas Today, which is a subsidiary of Encyclopedia Britannica. I met both boys a couple of times. Charles is... I came prepared not to like him because of that. I thought anybody...
You might tell what the incident was for the...
Well, for those of you who don't know, years ago on television, God knows how many years ago...
20 at least, 25.
Oh, surely not. I don't think radio was invented.
Oh, it was mid-50s, I think.
Yeah. There was a show called The $64,000 Question. You go in a booth and they feed you questions and you answer, and then you go on and win $5,000 and $7,500 and $10,000. And the suspense would build up. And it was so new around the country that literally everybody in America was watching that program, waiting to see who could possibly win $25,000. Charles Van Dorn answered, he was a very bright man. And he kept winning, and he kept winning, and he got the 25 big ones. And then the scandal broke that he had indeed been fed answers, or they would have given him books and say, here's a book of 500 pages, you'll find the answer on between page 595 and 596 with a marked paragraph and things like that. And it was a tremendous scandal. Now, if you watch stuff like that, they have this little disclaimer on the tube that says, some of these questions have been rehearsed in advance, like Hollywood Squares, they do that. They have to put that on there, and nobody gets any money for that anyway, so it's okay. But that was the first big scandal of TV. It was so big, in fact, that they had a House hearing on it in Washington, D.C., and they had to go down and testify, and it was, that's Charles, right. And as I said, I was prepared not to like him a whole lot, I guess, when I met him, but he's a very engaging guy. Very sensitive, very polite, and very friendly. And he just got caught up in something that was swept him along, and the money and the whole thing, and you know, there but for the grace of God, right? But both boys are very fine. Dorothy is still alive. She's 80 something. Drives a terrible car. I don't mean a terrible car, but she drives terrible. she pays no attention to boulevard stop signs whatsoever. She gets in the car and puts her foot on the accelerator, and you're just going to go back like this, and off she goes to market. She's 85, I guess, and she goes to a market that she's been going to for 50, 60 years. It's by a covered bridge in Cornwall, and that's another whole story, but it's very, very good poet. I like Cummings a good deal too, and thought maybe I'd read you a couple of E. Cummings poems. And I want to read Edna St. Vincent Millay too, especially since I forgot to tell you, I'm going to be reading my own poems Wednesday night, but I'm going to be sharing this place with a fellow who's sitting in the back there, Gary Barnes, who's a poet and artist who lives and teaches in Hong Kong and is over here for the summer. So Gary, who's not feeling very well right now, hope you recovered your reading voice by then. And Gary will be reading some of his poems too. Cummings. This is called I Thank You, Lord. Cummings was I'm on Hopkins, excuse me. Well, I'll stay on Hopkins. That's what I picked up. Read Cummings later. That's one thing. You bring too many books, this is bound to happen. You spend half your time looking for poems. This is another thing that happens.
What, you can't read your own writing?
Well, I did one page number for the wrong book, and I just turned to page 448, and it was Pope, and I knew Pope didn't have much to do with Cummings or Hopkins, so I figured I've got the wrong book. The wrong century and the wrong time zone, the whole thing. Here's Cummings. I'm back to Cummings.
Great.
That happens too often in my classes. Students just put down their books. I can't take notes. But we read a lot of poems. This is Cummings, I promise you. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. I wish you could see it on the page. I maybe should have Xeroxed it off. I probably did. It's back in the chalet. But Cummings had a thing about language. He thought language should be as inventive and as fresh as possible. And one of the ways he went about doing that was kind of disregarding punctuation and disregarding capital letters. He almost wrote everything in lowercase. And he would put in and, you know, instead of writing out and he would put in little squiggle lines and sometimes parenthetical things that have no reason to be in parentheses, and he would drop around and just kind of wild stuff. But that's neat. That's fresh. You have to do that to language once in a while to keep it honest. And in all the history of poetry, there's only been a handful of people who have paid attention to that kind of thing. Hopkins, who is also in my mind, is one of them, with his alliteration and lush sounds with doing it. In France, in the 1800s, Stephen Mallarmé, one of the French symbolist poets, did that. Last summer up here, I did a whole thing on French symbolism. Didn't bring my book this time. Mallarmé was so into what he could do with language that he finally got to the point, said, what I don't say is as important and sounds as interesting as what I do say. Listen to the silences. And people who were afraid to disagree for fear they'd seem ignorant say, yeah, it's heavy stuff. Like, he would write a line and leave out the last word. He'd say, hear that? And he'd say, oh, no. And then he would write a poem and leave out a whole line. And then he started leaving out in the middle of the line. Until finally, he wrote a poem called A Throw of the Dice, which I wish I had brought to show you. It's several pages long. Whole pages are blank. Or maybe a word down here in the bottom. And they would gather in his apartment above one of the boulevards in Paris and smoke a little French perfume cigarettes and wear the cravats and be bored as hell with life. And because they were just jaded, they suffered from what we know as ennui. And ennui is not just being bored. Ennui is you're so bored you just don't even want to draw breath. Let somebody else breathe for you. But he sent this poem to the publisher, to the editor, to be published. The editor took one look at it and sent it right back with a note saying, Mr. Mallarmé, something's happened to your poem. I don't know how to tell you, but we didn't do it. But words are missing. Whole pages are missing. And he sent it back and said, right, do it that way. So it took a few letters between the editor and Mallarmé to get that across. Actually, Mallarmé is really a fine poet. It's just that after a while, he started theorizing himself out of existence. And you can do that pretty easy when you get in too far into criticism and theory. That becomes more important than the content. And after a while, you start hearing so many silences that you just kind of drift off into the wild blue. The French symbolist poets were very influential on T.S. Eliot. And interestingly enough, after Eliot, some of the beat poets of the 50s in America, Allen Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti, and Gregory Corso. A lot of stuff you read by Ginsberg is very derivative of French. Anyway, back to Cummings, who was playing with language, is how I got on that digression. I had an education prof once at Long Beach State who said, never digress. And of course I don't, so there's never been any problem. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping, greenly spirits of trees, and for a blue, true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today. And this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. Now that's a sonnet, interestingly enough. It doesn't look like a sonnet. It doesn't sound like a sonnet. You know, Frost, who says, I'm going to go out and clean the pasture spring, and you can come if you want to. Just very basic meat and potatoes poetry, and Cummings is a little different. He plays with language. He bends words. A little harder to follow, but still a tremendous poet. They all had their own way to do it, and who says one is greater than the other? When I read Cummings, he's my favorite poet. When I read Whitman, he's my favorite poet. I think that's maybe the way it ought to be. He writes some tremendous poems that are very spiritual. And he also writes some poems that are rather bawdy, and all kinds of things in between. Here's one of my favorites that I just want to throw in. It's called May I Feel? May I feel, said he. I'll squeal, said she. Just once, said he. It's fun, said she. May I touch, said he. How much, said she. A lot, said he. Why not, said she. Let's go, said he. Not too far, said she. What's too far, said he. Where you are, said she. May I stay, said he. Which way, said she. Like this, said he. If you kiss, said she. May I move, said he. Is it love, said she. If you're willing, said he. But you're killing, said she. But it's life, said he. But your wife, said she. Now, said he. Ow, said she. Tip-top, said he. Don't stop, said she. Oh, no, said he. Go slow, said she. Come, said he. Mmm, said she. You're divine, said he. And you are mine, said she. All these guys are good. The first poem I ever read in Good Shepherd Lutheran School of Inglewood, California, when Mr. Offelman, who was my teacher, who was 9 feet tall and weighed 500 pounds, at least that's what he seemed to me in the seventh grade, he pounded his fist on the desk and he says, "Today we have poetry." No doubt about that. He didn't say, "You're ready for it? Can you get into it? And here's your motivation." He said, "Open your bloody book and read." And Norton again, back on the wrong thing. And the first lines I ever read, "This is the forest primeval," you know, in the with the murmuring pines and the hemlocks. And I thought, wow, what is a forest primeval? Had no idea what it was, but I was hooked and immediately liked it, just absolutely right off the bat. And this is the wrong book, too. And William Craig Miles, my arch enemy in the seventh grade, sat across from me. And he knew that I liked that. And he kept poking me, making fun of me. Yeah. And looking around, the other kids says, "Ledbetter likes it. Ledbetter likes it." So for 3 years, William and I fought tooth and nail on the playground. During kickball, during recess, we'd line up for lunch to get the milk, to get our shots when the nurse came, films, all those terrible films you see about the factories that you have no interest in that they get for free. We fought all the time on that. But that was my first poem. We finally, in the eighth grade, broke William's arm and shut him up for a while. William Craig Miles, and there was another person I remember in that class, this girl that I just was in love with in the seventh grade, her name was Laura Lee Appleton. I'm going to read some poems about Laura Lee Wednesday night. She's blonde, blue-eyed, and just an absolute angel. And then William on one side, Laura Lee on the other. What a way to go through life. And Mr. Uffelman in the middle saying, "Write sentences," because I dared question the doctrine of predestination. So I had this kind of a triumvirate of forces working on my psyche, fighting all day and
well, with those two bio, wasn't that sunshine and shadows?
It certainly was. Uh-huh. You bet. Who's to say which did the more harm, right?
Yes.
Or good. This is God's Grandeur by Hopkins, which is what I started to find a while ago. By the way, before I forget, which is very likely, some people have asked me to mention the tour. So, and I had 200 copies of an itinerary, and I've left them in the chalet too. So I'll bring them Wednesday if you want to take a look at them. You can have them. Rich Kammerer, the artist here at Holden, who did the ceiling in the Village Center and lots of other things. Rich and I led a tour to Europe and Greece and Jerusalem last summer, and I'm going to do the tour again next summer, summer of 79. It'll cover about 12 countries and 6 weeks long. It'll be art and music and literature and history. You can take it for credit or just go along for the fun of it, any age. And so if you're interested, see me about, and I'll give you a brochure as the countries and the time and everything. This is God's Grandeur by Gerard Manley Hopkins. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with soil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest, freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with awe bright wings. It's always been one of my favorite religious poems. Love to hear this from the pulpit, don't hear it often enough. Hopkins was a priest, Catholic priest, and a great poet. But this idea, and for all of this, nature is never spent. And you really get that impression, I think, in a place like Holden, where you look around the water and the sky and everything green. You know, nature is never done. No matter what we may do to the world, nature is never spent, which is his metaphor, obviously, for God, for Christ, for life. And this line, and though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. And these two lines are mind blowers. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with awe bright wings. One of the greatest metaphors of the Holy Spirit I've ever heard. Brooding over the world with warm breast and bright wings. Fantastic poem. Here's Pied Beauty, Hopkins. You know what Pied is? I took journalism in high school, and we had our own print shop. And I found out what Pied meant because I knocked over the bloody tray of type. And the print shop guy was a little man, Mr. Shotliff or something, shirt cuff or some little guy about 4'5". And he would look, and he said, pick him up, Ledbetter. And I got down, I said, well, I'll just pick him up. He said, no, you just don't pick him up like that. You throw him in. He said, you pick him up with these tweezers. And he handed me these tweezers. One at a time, and the type is upside down, you know. So you go blind. After 4 hours, I was still picking up. I never did it again because I got that thing just right. Pied beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of a couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple trout. Wait a minute. For rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim. Fresh fire coal chestnut falls. Finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. That's a tremendous poem for our particular time in the 20th century, when we seem to live in this era of you have to be young, you have to be slim, you have to be beautiful, and you have to smell good. And if you're not any of those things, forget it. You're on the wrong track, you know. And here's a guy who's saying, thank God for things that are funny, for odd somehow, got spots on them, you know. It's like in creative writing I teach at school, I have the students do a series of exercises over the semester, and one of them, they write on snow. And they say, oh yeah, we'll write on snow, and start writing. And after a while, they have pencils saying, I can't say anything about snow. What can you say? It's cold, it's wet, it's white, it looks like a marshmallow. I said, no, don't say any of those things. It's terrible. But it's true, that's why it's terrible. I said, well, how do you write about snow? And then I said, well, have you ever seen snow? Yeah. Have you ever been on the farm or been in the Midwest or the North or East? Yeah. Well, write about what you see there. Snow on cars, slushy things, a fence post sticking out, a little blob of snow on it like shaving cream, the corners of a house disappearing in a snowbank. They soon get the picture that when you write about something like that, you're not actually writing so much about it as you're writing about its effect on nature and nature's effect on it. And they said, well, yeah, but then you're not writing about snow. You're writing about Oh, I see, I see. The interconnection of things. And that's when snow is beautiful, is when it's on something else. I said, well, that's what Hopkins was about.
Except when it's in a blizzard.
In a blizzard.
Then it's not beautiful.
That's right. Well, it's, if you're home,
it's okay.
It's all right.
When you're out in it.
Yeah, well, I guess so. I must admit, maybe I've been in California too long. And,
well, I'm speaking from experience.
Yeah? Where are you from?
Montana.
Oh, boy.
Originally.
They have blizzards there, don't they?
Tell me about it.
Yeah, no, I can't tell you about it. I'll pass, thanks. I'll pass on that one. Okay, I'm going to close with a poem or two by Millay, because I said I would. And I know Gary likes in the same, and I like her too. She's very, I was going to read Emily Dickinson. I didn't get to, I'll read her next week. Maybe I'll sneak her in with some of mine. I guess she won't mind. Edna St. Vincent Millay is not in great vogue right now, whatever that means, by people who, what does that clock say?
You got about...
It's 22 minutes.
22
before.
Minutes to 8.
Okay, I'll make this one.
Dickinson
short.
Seems to be, though. Is it
Dickinson,
of
yeah.
The play? There was a recent...
On television?
Well, was it Julie Harris?
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
Woman show?
Yeah.
Is that what is...
Oh, well, I'm sure that's helped, yeah. And Dickinson has come into her own because people over several years have realized that she's a great poet. I think she and and Whitman are probably the greatest poet, and Frost. I start out with one person, like my 10 favorite books are, and then they got a list this long. My 10 favorite poets, and Shakespeare, and Chaucer, and somebody else has to get up there. Dante comes in with his foot and tries to hang on to the pinnacle. And she's big. I had a graduate class at Nebraska once with a pompous ass of an instructor. It was a seminar on Frost and Dickinson. And we were all about 12 of us in this room. And he walked in with this ferret-like grimace in his eye and kind of a funereal set to his mouth. And he said, he says, how many poems by Emily Dickinson have you read? And the guy says, 1,206. He went to the next guy, he's, how about 915? Right around there, he came to me and I said, dozen? And everybody was quiet, and they all turned my way. I knew I was in trouble. I only lasted about 2 days in that class. It turned out it was a class on textual criticism, which meant was he was interested in finding out why Emily Dickinson used a dash instead of a comma, and why Frost used a semicolon instead of a colon in one poem. I said, I can't take that, fellas. I really like to find out what they were as people and how their poems read. I don't give a rip about a semicolon or a dash. I don't care. So I was, I'm going on like that to you, but I certainly didn't say it to the ferret because he turned out to be my advisor. So he was Mr. Nice Ferret when I was talking to him. Semi-nice ferret. As nice as a ferret can ever be, I suppose. What did I start out looking for? Who was I looking for?
Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Okay, thank you. Here we are. I'm going to read, Love is Not All, It's Not Meat or Drink. It's a sonnet, which I like very much. Love is not all. It's not meat, nor drink, nor slumber, nor a roof against the rain, nor yet a floating spar to men that sink and rise and sink and rise and sink again. Love cannot fill the thickened lung with breath, nor clean the blood, nor set the fractured bone. Yet many a man is making friends with death, even as I speak, for lack of love alone. It well may be that in a difficult hour, pinned down by pain and moaning for release, or nagged by want past resolution's power, I might be driven to sell your love for peace, or trade the memory of this night for food. It well may be. I do not think I would. I like that sonnet. I just like the feel of it. And it's kind of an ironic thing, I think. I have no way of proving it, so I wouldn't argue it. But I like the tension there, depending how you read that, right? I might be driven to sell your love for peace or trade the memory this night for food. It well may be. I do not think I would. You know, the resolution. Or it well may be. I do not think I would. I mean, that puts a whole new ballgame on her love and her love affairs, and so forth. You got to read, you have to say Vincent Millay is a great, great gal, had a rip-roaring time. Rode in the rumble seat in cars that did 20 miles an hour, smoked cigarettes when all the proper young ladies of New England were not supposed to, and...
Different from Emily Dickinson.
Oh, yeah. Emily spent her, for all intents and purposes, spent her lifetime in her father's garden in Amherst, and after a certain period never went out, was recluse and wore white clothes and didn't talk to anybody, but boy, did she write poems. Oh, Emily Dickinson carried a love affair for two men for 20 years, completely platonic. The guys didn't even know about
it.
Never knew it, and neither of them was worth it, from what I know of them. They were a couple of clucks. And when finally this, I'm going to close with this one. Finally, the second man in her life moved away. She wrote a poem called "My Life Closed Twice," if I can remember it. My life closed twice before its close. It yet remains to see if immortality unveil a third event to me. So huge, so hopeless to conceive, as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven, and all we need of hell. That's Emily Dickinson. Concise, like a safe falling out of a building on your head. Well, I think time has been used up. Obviously, I got 1,000 more poets, but I can't get them in, so I hope you've enjoyed these, and come again. Thank you.
Thank you.